This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today we begin the first of a two-part tribute to the late actor and monologist Spalding Gray. He was perhaps the first and probably the best and most influential contemporary performer of onstage autobiographical monologues. We'll hear interviews with him from our archive and new interviews about him. When he disappeared January 10th, his family and friends feared that he had committed suicide by jumping off the Staten Island ferry. Earlier this month, his body was found in New York's East River. He was 62. Gray had always wrestled with depression. It was often the subject of his monologues. But his depression became consuming after a car accident in 2001 that shattered his hip, fractured his skull, and caused a brain injury. Most of Gray's fans probably felt like they knew him. In his monologues, he would share the kind of personal stories that many people wouldn't even confide to a best friend. His shows were extraordinary. He was an actor whose best performances were portraying himself in his monologues. Although he was dyslexic and had trouble writing, he was incredibly gifted at telling stories. No matter what the subject was, his latest phobia, physical disorder, or relationship crisis, he could get you laughing without diminishing the gravity of the problem. The ability to stand back and report on his life was his artistic gift. He thought it was also his problem. He was always standing back, observing and thinking. Several of his stories were about this predicament. He wanted to experience a perfect moment, but that was usually impossible because he was too trapped in his own mind to let go. Here's a brief excerpt of his monologue, It's a Slippery Slope, about learning to ski. This was recorded in 1996 at the Goodman Theater in Chicago.
Barney and I start up with all of the locals, and we begin to ski, and I find I'm only going left. I'm going left into the bushes, coming out the other side with branches in my mouth, you know, like a Botticelli. And I say, I won't bother you. I know I got to do this on my own. You go ski. I'm going over to Meadow. I go over to Meadow, the green slope. And I am inspired that day. When I see what I see, it's the adaptive ski school. And they are taking quadriplegics out of wheelchairs and putting them in gondolas with these little ski runners. And they have poles with skis on them. And I think, Spalding, if you can't turn right on this slope today, give it up. Now, I have no instructor. I'm trying to do this on my own. And I begin, and I'm left and crashing, and yard sale. All stuff is all over, picking up my stuff. But you know what I'm impressed by is how wildly I can crash and still get up without anything broken. And it's left and crash, and left and crash, and then it happens. It's the ineffable. I can't tell you how it happens. All the time I think I had to think myself around, it was just a shift of weight, and I never experienced this in my life except in 1946 on Thanksgiving Day when I first learned how to pump on a swing. I suddenly turned right, or something turned me right, and then left, right, left, boom, down. But I was up again, left, right, left. People would ski by me real fast, I'd crash. People would ski by me and fall, I'd crash. I was in such empathy. Or I'd be skiing and thinking, you're doing it, you're skiing. Crash. It was so beautiful. It was like Zen, but a little not as subtle, you know? If you weren't present, you crashed and a mountain hit you. I mean, and I realized at that point that all my life I'd been doing a kind of subtle suicide to myself. I'd always be somewhere else in my head. I was always thinking, oh, I could be there, or I could be there, I could be there. Or I wish I was there. But now when I'm skiing, I don't have that as long as I'm skiing. And I'm so excited. I get down to lunch to join Barney, and we go over to the Blue Slope. And I'm going to ski with him, and now it's a two-die day. It is a perfect day that reminds me of the old days, the Thornton Burgess books my father used to read to me, the West Wind stories, when you'd see the cloud with a face and a wind puffing out of its lips. That's how the clouds looked. Only there weren't wind, it was these long chains of snow flurries. And then the clouds would pass and the bright California sun would light the packed snow, and there were furrows where other people had skied, and we were hopping through the furrows in other people's rhythm, and we were riding up. We were dancing in the day. I was with a man, and we weren't talking, we were skiing together, and I couldn't stop. At the end of the day, they had to restrain me. I tried to bribe the lift operator for another run. Barney said, easy, easy, easy. You've been skiing for 7 hours. I'd never done anything for 7 hours in my life. And never thought of death once.
An excerpt of It's a Slippery Slope. We'll hear more performance excerpts from Spalding Gray, as well as interviews with him, tomorrow. In a few minutes, we'll hear from his widow, Kathleen Russo, first an interview with his good friend, Robbie Stein. After the car accident in 2001, Gray stayed at Stein's house for a while. Stein last saw Gray 5 days before he disappeared. Stein is a child psychoanalyst. We talked about Spalding Gray and his depressions. In our interview after his monologue, Swimming to Cambodia, he had mentioned that a lot of people on the set, on location, were smoking a lot of very heavy-duty marijuana, and that Spalding had mentioned that marijuana made him paranoid. So I asked, well, why would you smoke it if it makes you paranoid? And he said, well, I'm interested in exploring psychotic states. What did you understand about that aspect of him, about his interest in actually exploring psychotic states?
I think a lot of his personality was testing things. He believed, in a sense, let's just look at that for a minute, that by exploring something, he would go into it and to the edge of it and then could come back. And that enabled him to have a sense of both survival and control. I think he felt that if he didn't experience things in the world, that they would take him over, as opposed to him being able in some way to live with it and, in effect, control it. Although he was much more of an observer than an active participant in his state. In that way, you know, rather than someone who was going out to fix himself, he was going out to experience himself in every way possible.
And then and then he'd always report on it for us, his audience.
Exactly. And I think that was hopeful for many. You know, he somehow came back always. I think that's what's so shocking now for so many, for many people who are friends, is that the reality of that he didn't come back.
Yeah. I'm so interested in how Spalding transformed his life and his neuroses and panics into art, into theater that so many of us, you know, found ourselves in and got such pleasure from. Did you observe that process at all? Do you have any insights that you could share with us?
Well, he was a literary person. I mean, if I talk for a second about Morning, Noon, and Night, it comes out of, you know, our town. It comes out of the four quartets from Eliot. He understood it deeply. He, you know, he transformed that into his life. And he would use, you know, those works, for example, in that monologue, to frame what his day was like. And then he often would say he didn't have the ability to create fiction. You know, he just really told the truth in terms of what he saw. Not that he was seeking the truth in inverted commas. It was that, you know, there were these strange coincidences. I mean, when he moved to the road in the house that the family now lives in, and that was a big conflict for him, or what he obsessed over was that move. They changed the road's name from Ferry Road to Lost at Sea Memorial Pike.
Gee.
Now, you know, I mean, it was, you know, that was very typical of these coincidences, which seem both tragic and funny at the same time, if you knew him at the time.
How did his mental state change after the accident?
The degree of his obsessiveness was unrelenting, and he described it as never stopping. In other words, it was if he was listening to a tape that had no end except that ended in his end, which is what he talked about. And unlike other times where it would feel like it was part of a rehearsal that was becoming art, this felt like it was a terrifying and painful experience that he couldn't change.
I mean, you're a therapist as well as as well as having been a close friend of Spalding's. Would you try to talk him out of things that were obviously delusional, paranoid beliefs?
Sure, yeah.
Is it helpful to try to talk somebody out of delusions, or is that hopeless?
It's not hopeless, but it's not also something that anyone can really do in any predictable way. I mean, I think what many of us tried to do with Spalding was to contain him and challenge him. He was in Payne Whitney for, I believe, 3 months at one point and had a lot of electric shocks. Afterwards, Kathy picked him up and myself, another friend, Donna Lipsky, and Howie Michaels, his other godfather, brought him to Howie's house, and we spent 3 days, 2 nights with him, really hands-on, you know, challenging everything in a direct way, making him talk, getting him to cook, re-engaging him in the world. And he came out of it a bit. But I think what is hard for anyone to really digest is that this was like a cancer. If it was pancreatic cancer, it would feel different. But it was something that kept coming back and coming back. And even when he wanted to. I really believe he wanted to. It was we talked about this. It was almost like he was on a permanent acid trip and not sleeping for months and months and months. It never stopped. And that, again, is, I think, important to understand about how that wasn't the same as the person who, you know, we all, you know from the monologues. And that was a direct effect, I think, in effect, the frontal lobe damage.
Did you think he'd really go through with the suicide?
I hate to say this, but yes. And that's, you know, I wish I didn't feel that way, but unfortunately, I had supervised hospital in London when I worked there for many years, the ward of suicide ward, and it was becoming more and more evident to me that nothing was happening. I think I should have recognized a little bit more, but how could I guess, that in the end, when he was more organized and calmer, that was the most dangerous sign. And I certainly talked to friends and family.
Wait, let me stop you there, because that's something that I don't really understand. You know, just as it appeared like he was getting a little better and he started to do his monologue about life after the accident, that's when he killed himself. And you said that there's often a period of calm that somebody who's suicidal uses as an opportunity to take their life. Could you explain that?
Well, I think what happens is the answer's there. That in some way, the pain of it all, the way you see people suffering around you, the way in which your anger can be ameliorated, and he was angry, that what happened was that the way out became an end to all of that, and it became the only way. And I think when he resolved how he was going to do it, and I think before they were tentative practices, there was relief. There was, in a profound way, I think that's what happens. I think the person feels, they see that they can end the pain, and it's clear. And at that moment, they make a plan, and that's when they're resolved, and also it's most dangerous.
Thank you very much for talking with us. I really appreciate you sharing some of your memories of Spalding Gray. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Robbie Stein is a child psychoanalyst in private practice in New York City. Today we're remembering actor and performance artist Spalding Gray. My guest is his widow, Kathleen Russo. They had two sons together who are now 11 and 6 years old. Russo runs the Washington Square Arts and Films Agency, which used to represent Gray. Fans of Gray's work will know Russo as a character in his monologues. In fact, she entered the monologues in a part of his life that stunned his fans. While he was in a long-term relationship with Renee Shafransky, the woman who became his first wife, he had an affair with Kathy. She got pregnant and gave birth to a son. Several months later, Gray left his wife to be with Kathy, their son, and her daughter from a previous relationship. I talk with Russo about Gray, their relationship, his work, and the monologue that he was working on about his life after the car crash, called Life Interrupted. On stage, he had this distance, this ironic distance, and this kind of repertorial ability to comment on the things that really troubled him. Was he able to have that kind of distance and that kind of ability to look at himself and laugh in real life?
I would say yes. It would take some time, but I would say yes. But after the accident, no. No, it became very difficult for him to have distance. And what I was hoping when he was working on this new monologue, Life Interrupted, that would help him start creating that distance so he could get beyond this big, complicated crisis that happened to him 2.5 years ago. But it really, for the first time, it wasn't happening. And that's the thing about It's a Slippery Slope and Morning, Noon, and Night and Grey's Anatomy and Monster in a Box. I mean, once he was on stage, it really helped therapeutically for him to get distance from whatever was plaguing him that he's talking about in the monologues.
Kathy, I just have a quick question about what it was like for you as his wife when he was on stage. You entered the picture in the monologues in Slippery Slope. And, you know, Grey's Anatomy, the monologue before that, ends with him getting married with grave reservations to Renee Schifransky. And he's about to, back out of the whole thing when mm-hmm. when the monologue ends, but they do get married. And in Morning, Noon, and Night, he talks about how, you know, while he was married, he has an affair with you, you get pregnant, and he tells the story in Slippery Slope and in Morning, Noon, and Night. And I always couldn't imagine what it was like for you to have such a kind of private thing played out on stage and to have people who don't know you form opinions of you by Spalding's
Which
monologues.
Which they did, yeah. Right,
Of course. So
it was not easy. It was not easy, especially once we were public as a couple. It was easier before we were public, obviously, because I could just sit in the audience and no one knew who I was. But once people realized who I was, especially when he was playing Grey's Anatomy and we were living together then, and people would assume, you know, if they didn't know that they had broken up, that I was Renee. And I'll never forget this one time at Lincoln Center, this woman came up and she was so happy to meet me that I didn't correct her. I just was like, thank you. Thank you. Because she was like this 80-year-old little woman. She was just so thrilled to meet who she thought was Renee, the character, that I just let her believe it. But I felt a lot of scrutiny. I felt until it became apparent to the audience that this family that he definitely wanted but wasn't sure he wanted until he got into the thick of it really, really gave him a lot of joy. And then that's when people, I felt, audience members accepted me better. But at first, it was extremely difficult to sit there and listen to him getting married to someone else and know that we had this other life going on at home.
He didn't expect to be a father. He didn't, you know, he didn't plan on being a father. And it was a surprise to him when he became a father. I'm wondering what it was like to watch him change his attitude. I mean, you know, just knowing him from his monologues, he fell so deeply in love with his children. Can you talk a little bit about watching that transformation from being just so, like, not interested in having children to falling in love with them?
Well, for me, because I had a daughter when we met, and she was 3 years old, I knew he was going to be a great dad because he was so good with her and playful and engaging that I just thought this man, you know, would be a great dad if he wanted to be. And he really, I think he talks about this in Slippery Slope, he was attracted to me because I had a child, too. That was a first for him as well. And he was actually told that he couldn't have children. I mean, that there was something wrong there, he couldn't have children. So I think he kind of thought, well, it's not going to happen. It's not in the cards for me. This woman has a child. This is an interesting situation, one that I'm not used to. And let's explore this a little bit. And then, obviously, when I got pregnant with Forrest, it was a shock to him. He had no idea that he could even make someone pregnant. And we'd been together for quite some time, and you know, nothing had happened before like that. But when he first saw Forrest, which wasn't until Forrest was 8 months old, it was immediate. It was a very natural thing that came to him as soon as he held his son for the first time. And he, I mean, I have to say, to my credit, I was really, you know, I, before he saw Forrest, I was just like, let him come to me. If he knows we're here, if he wants a relationship with his son, he knows how to reach me. And as soon as he came and met Forrest and bonded with him that first night, then I said to him, you know what? You need some time alone with your son. And he had a place upstate at the time. And I said, why don't you take Forrest there for the weekend and see what it's like to be a dad on your own without me hovering over, you know, changing the diaper, this and that. You go. You take him. And he did. And I think it was really quite an experience. And he talks about it in Slippery Slope. I mean, Forrest was weaned from breastfeeding, but he got up in the middle of the night and he's screaming for a bottle, and Spalding left it in the car and he had to go out and he couldn't find it. And he's giving him milk out of a shot glass because he didn't know what else to do to get him to calm down. And he's changing the diapers, and it was the best thing I think I could have done was just leave him alone for the weekend and really see what it was like to be a dad. And when he brought Forrest back, it wasn't like, phew, I'm glad this weekend's over. It was like, I want more.
Kathleen Russo will talk more about her late husband, the actor and performance artist Spalding Gray, in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today and tomorrow, we're remembering the late actor and monologist Spalding Gray. His depressions were a frequent subject of his monologues. He never recovered from the depression that followed the car accident in 2001 that shattered his hip and fractured his skull. His body was found in the East River earlier this month. His family thinks he committed suicide. Let's pick up where we left off with his widow, Kathleen Russo. They had two sons together who were now 11 and 6 years old. He didn't expect to become a father. He didn't think he wanted to be one. Russo says that once Gray spent time with his son, Gray's attitude changed.
He was not so much the narcissist that we all, you know, remember in the earlier monologues. And it was a welcome change for his friends and family members to see him take the role as a caretaker and not have himself come first for the first time in his life.
Do you think that helped?
Interesting transformation.
Did that help get him out of his head, because he was so he was so absorbed on his mental state, and it was great for his art, but I bet he would have liked to get out of his head more often.
He did get out of his head, and it wasn't just the children. For the first time, he said, in a relationship with a woman, I'm very athletic, I'm very outdoorsy, and I took him camping for the first time. I bought him a bicycle and make him, you know, bike 10 miles a day was like a normal thing for us to do. And I found through exercise that Spalding was able to finally get out of his head. And the skiing in the winter played a big part of that. I bought him his first pair of skis. He was such an indoor guy when I first met him that to spend 8 hours outside for him was unheard of. And I grew up upstate New York, and for me, you know, being stuck in the city was almost unbearable at times. So I was like, we need to get out, we need to go hiking, we need to go biking. And he really appreciated that I would, you know, push him to do these things because it would clear his head. And with the children, he could just get into their world, and it was a great escape for him. He welcomed it at any moment. You know, he never felt like fatherhood was work. It really felt, it was, I would say 99.9% of the time, it was really enjoyable for him.
I remember in I think it was our interview after Morning, Noon, and Night, which was his interview about being in a family, he said he didn't want to turn his family, particularly his children, into a sitcom. And he wanted to protect the family from that.
Right.
But I found myself wondering, since Spalding's life was the material for his art, where would that lead him? If the main focus of his life, his family, was going to be off limits for the monologues, what would he write about? So did the joy of having a family also kind of change what the central focus of his art was going to be?
Yeah. Right. It presented an obstacle for the first time where he felt. See, I didn't believe him when he said he wasn't going to write about the family again. I was like, you'll eventually get to it, but it'll be something else. It won't just be about our everyday life. It'll be some crisis involving one of our family members, maybe, or something. But it was an obstacle. And before we went to Ireland, he was really having a writer's block where he felt, okay, Morning, Noon, and Night is about 4 years old now. What do I do next? And in hindsight now, looking back, I think he was starting to panic about where he was going to go to next in his, you know, work, what the next monologue was going to be.
Can we talk about the accident?
Mm-hmm.
The family went to Ireland for his 60th birthday.
Right.
And you were in a car accident there. What happened?
Well, unfortunately, it was only the second day we were there. And if you've been to Ireland, we were in County Westmeath, which is in the middle of Ireland. And the roads there are really, we've been there many times, but the roads, particularly in this country roads, were very narrow. And you had to slow down to let another car go by you. It was that tight. So we, the five adults, went out for dinner, and my daughter and her cousin were watching the kids back at this place that we were staying. It was John Scanlon's place, the big PR guy who unfortunately died a month before we were to arrive at his place in Ireland, but his widow still insisted that we go because she said he would have really wanted us to use the place. But, of course, now you look back on that as, well, there's a sign. So we were coming back from this restaurant, and it was just starting to get dark, and we're coming to a fork in the road. And I was going to turn right, and I saw through the hedges this car just coming right at us. And I was driving. Spaulding and two other women were in the back, and the person that was renting the car I was driving was next to me. And because I became the designated driver at dinner, because everyone else was drinking too much. And I saw the headlights, and it was, whenever someone describes an accident to you, they say everything slows down. It's true. It's like, it probably took 2 seconds, but it felt like, 10 minutes for this to happen, the crash. And he crashed right into us head on. We weren't even moving. And then we all blacked out, and I remember waking up, and the engine's on my lap, and there's smoke all over the car, and people are moaning and screaming, and I just thought, I've got to get out of this car somehow. I just have to. And I thought I was internally bleeding. And when I finally opened up the car door and fell out, there was Spaulding on the ground, and I couldn't even see his face. It was, full of blood. And he was out of it. I thought he was dead.
What were his injuries?
At the time, they told us just that he shattered his hip, which when he came to, that's all he complained to. He said, oh, my hip, and he couldn't move. And but later on, we found out that he'd also fractured his head, but it wasn't until almost a month after the accident that they discovered it, despite me protesting for them to, or begging them to please do MRIs on his head. They said, oh, no, he doesn't have a fracture. It's just his hip.
Kathy, what were your injuries?
Actually, the airbag, I think, did the most injuries. It just bruised the tissues around my heart. So they were really keeping me in for observation to make sure that, I didn't internally bleed, I guess. And I was there for 5 days. And after 5 days, they still wanted to keep me there. And I just left because I couldn't do anything from the hospital. I knew it was a country hospital, and I knew I had to get Spaulding out of there. And I couldn't even make phone calls from the hospital. So I just left and went back to the place we were staying and immediately got on the phone and got in touch with the head of the Irish Arts Council, Patrick Murphy, and who helped me move Spaulding to an orthopedic hospital outside Dublin. And I knew he needed something else other than that. So as soon as we got him to the orthopedic hospital, almost a week later, they said he absolutely needs an operation. We have to put a metal plate in his hip. And apparently we got the best orthopedic surgeon in Ireland to do it. And he did a good job from what we could tell.
But I think he had several subsequent hip surgeries after that too, didn't he?
Well, he did have one just this past September, because what happened is the nerve damage from the accident, as the scar tissue built up, he had what you would call a drop foot. He couldn't feel the top of his foot, and he had to wear a brace up to his knee all the time, or he would trip. And for Spalding, as I was telling you before, how physically active he used to be, that meant hikes were out. He couldn't hike anymore because the brace really interfered with that. He could bike. That was okay for some reason. But the hiking, the walking, he missed enormously. It was, he felt like an old man overnight, you know, at 60 years old because of this injury. So the operation he had in September, they went back in, they scraped the scar tissue off the sciatic nerve, and they felt it was a successful operation, and they said it's going to, you know, your nerve grows back a millimeter a day. So they thought it would be a year to 18 months before we saw any change in his leg. But they were hopeful that this was the right, you know, decision, and that he would be able to walk one day without a brace.
My guest is Kathy Russo. We'll talk more about her late husband, Spalding Gray, after a break. This is Fresh Air. Today and tomorrow, we're remembering the late actor and performance artist Spalding Gray. His body was found in the East River earlier this month, an apparent suicide. He never physically or mentally recovered from a car accident in 2001. Did you feel like you recognized, like, was he a different person in your mind?
He became that slowly, yes, yes. And, you know, I have to say, right after the accident, he really was... He did really well right after the accident. It wasn't until September 11th, 2001, which, of course, was the World Trade Center, and it was also our moving day in Sag Harbor. Way back, 6 months prior to that, we decided to move from our cute little village home to a bigger, older house a mile outside the village. And for Spalding, he chose to focus on this move as what was really, you know, the point of no return. I felt that he felt that moving from his beloved Sag Harbor house to this house outside the village was the thing that was responsible for his downfall. Not the accident, really, just this move, what it represented to him in his mind. And that became his focus. And he started to obsess on it like he has, you know, obsessed on other things, but it went way beyond any other obsession he's ever had before.
That must have been really difficult for you because, I mean, you probably helped organize the move, and, you know.
I did it all, right?
Yeah. Right, and so, I mean, what do? Do you feel really guilty about it, or do you just say this is kind of irrational behavior?
Well, you know, I have to remind myself that when we bought the house in February of 2001, that we did it together. And that he was of sound mind and body at that time, and that we both realized we were going to miss living in the village, but we realized that we needed more room for our growing family, especially as the boys got bigger. For Spalding, it was easier to blame the move because, look, there's a solution to every problem. I would say to him over and over, if you don't like where we're living, let's go back to the village. Let's find a house that works for us in the village. Let's just do it. I don't care where we live. But I care about you being happy. And we would do this. We spent 2 years looking at places in the village, and he would always come up with something wrong with that house. It wasn't the old house. He would always compare it to the old house. That's all he wanted was the old house. But he wanted his old life back. And I just have to remind myself that it was this neurosis that prevented him from seeing any solutions to the problem. And that that I was willing to assist him in any way to come up with a solution, but that he just didn't want my help. It was something that he, you know, was just determined to live out somehow.
Did you feel you could reach him? You know, that he was communicative and that you were able to reach him in the way that you were before?
It was really hard. It was really hard, but I have to say, even till the last day I saw him, we still, you know, as much as we would fight about, you know, his condition and this, that, we still had a very loving relationship. And thank God, the last exchange that we had, we hugged and kissed each other and told each other that we loved each other. And I had given him for Christmas a trip to Aspen, and I was helping him with his luggage to meet the town car waiting for him outside. And when he kissed me, he said, thanks for the trip, honey. And I looked at him and I go, you never call me honey. Thanks. I mean, he never called me honey. And I thought, wow, he must really appreciate this trip. He's looking forward to it. It was a really sweet exchange. But even though I couldn't reach him in the 2.5 years, I did reach him, but it was harder to reach him. We still had a very loving relationship.
When did you start worrying about suicide?
Probably in June of 2002.
What changed that made the possibility of that a reality?
We were traveling California. He was performing there, and I had to go back to, because the kids had school, I had to go back, and he was going to go on the tour by himself. And the performances, they were not great, but they were good. I mean, he remounted Swimming to Cambodia for UCLA to enthusiastic audiences. The reviews were good. People said, well, he walks with a limp now. He looks older, the critics. But the work was still being reviewed quite well. He wouldn't get out of bed. He was in this hotel, and he wouldn't get out of bed. And I said, that's it. We're canceling the rest of your tour. You need to come home, and you need to rest. And we've got to figure out what we can do for you, because working and being on the road obviously is not the answer. And when he came home, that's when I became really concerned that he might do something to end his life, because he started talking about it for the first time. I mean, look, he's always talked about his fantasies of suicide that predates my relationship with him, but it was the first time I took him seriously about it wasn't just a fantasy. He was actually thinking, maybe I should end it all now.
Did you have a sense of what was going on in his head that was causing him such pain that he wanted to take his life? I mean, and do you think it was the mental pain that was more significant than the physical pain?
Well, this is a hard one, because I do believe that the brain injury, it was brain trauma. I mean, he had an extensive head trauma from the fracture. The surgeon said there were literally hundreds of pieces of bone lodged in his brain that he had to get out. So I think for Spalding, he was prone to depression anyway, and I think it was almost like it was, as I said before, Ireland, he was starting to panic about what he was going to do next. I think there were signs that maybe a depression was coming on, but I think in combination with this head injury, it was more than he could process, that he was able to process physically and emotionally. And he needed a lot of help, which, you know, I mean, the places that we went to at the time I thought were, you know, some of the best places. But you realize until you're in the thick of it, you need to question everything. I mean, doctors are human. And wait, did I answer your question?
I'm just still thinking about hundreds of pieces of bone lodged in his brain. That's just horrifying.
It's horrible.
And what makes it even worse is knowing that it took a while before the doctors realized it.
Detected it, right?
Yeah.
Right. It was me saying to the doctors, so you have to realize in Ireland, everything's specialized. He was in an orthopedic hospital. So by the time we got there, they didn't do the MRIs that I requested at the country hospital on his head. And so I thought, all right, well, maybe they were right. His head looks fine. We were playing Scrabble with the kids in his hospital bed after his hip operation, and I literally saw his head sink in. I mean, I saw this little portion of his head above his eyebrow all of a sudden go in. I said, Spalding, your head just caved in. He goes, oh, my God, get a doctor. And the doctors run in, and they're like, well, we're orthopedic doctors. We can't help you here. We've got to send you to another hospital that specializes and head injuries. So off he goes to yet another hospital in Ireland. And it was at that hospital, because if Spalding talks about it in Life Interrupted, it was actually, he goes, it was like something out of National Geographic. The doctors all walk in, all 10 of them, and he goes, and there's now one Irish doctor in the whole group. And he just said, they're all talking with different accents and telling me, some of them are saying, no, he can fly home to have the operation. And others are saying, No, he needs to stay here and have the operation. He can't fly. And they're going, they're arguing amongst themselves, and I was there, about what he should do. And I just looked at the whole situation and Spalding being in yet another dormitory room. And the thought of having a head operation in Ireland was just, you know, I couldn't see it. So I immediately got on the phone and we found the head neurosurgeon at New York Presbyterian to agree to operate or see Spalding right away. And I think we flew home 3 days after that.
What, if anything, did you feel you had in your power to do when you started to think that Spalding was serious about suicide?
Oh, gosh, that's a hard question. I felt pretty powerless. I mean, look, I could easily talk him into going to another hospital, quote, to keep him safe. But I knew that I could not institutionalize him, which is what some doctors actually told me to do with him. And I wasn't going to believe that that was the only solution. And Spalding and I, you know, we talked about this at great length. It was like, I go, I promise you, I will. This was after he had been in many hospitals. I said, I will not institutionalize you. That, to me, that's not a life, just to keep you safe. Safe from what? But you have to work with me here, you know. And I would say to him, I was like, if you're feeling suicidal, please tell me, tell your doctor. Let's, you know, just give it some time. All these doctors are saying, you're looking at a 5-year recovery period. We're halfway there. Believe me, it's worth it. And I will work with you every day if I have to. But please don't, you know, do anything impulsively. Please, let's, if you're feeling really suicidal, you know, I think I asked him on a daily basis, how do you feel today? Do you feel suicidal? No, no, I haven't had any suicidal thoughts today. No, he would tell me.
So what you believe happened is that he jumped off a Staten Island ferry?
Well, that's from the facts that we have. That's what it looks like. Although someone told me they read in one of the papers as to where his body showed up that they thought maybe he jumped from one of the bridges. I don't know. But I would think that would have shown up on a... I don't have the autopsy yet, but I would think that would show up. I mean, they said that he definitely drowned.
My guest is Kathy Russo. We'll talk more about her late husband, Spalding Gray, after a break. This is Fresh Air. Today and tomorrow, we're remembering the late actor and performance artist, Spalding Gray. His body was found in New York's East River earlier this month, an apparent suicide. He never physically or mentally recovered from the car accident that seriously injured him in 2001. You know, I've thought so much about Spalding's body being in the river for weeks before it was found. And, you know, I just couldn't help thinking back about how water figured into a couple of his monologues. You know, in Swimming to Cambodia, he's looking for his perfect moment, and he finds it swimming in the ocean far from shore, right, where instead of worrying about getting back, he forgets about that momentarily and just feels at one with everything and has that perfect moment. But in a later monologue, he's swimming out at sea, I think in a
before
New
he got
York
married.
Beach. Yeah.
Right.
And he realizes he swam out too far, he's not gonna be able to get back, he's afraid he's drowning. And Renee, the woman he's with at the time, you know, forces like two guys who aren't lifeguards, right, to go out and come bring him in. So he had these two opposite experiences of water that he made public in his monologues. And I don't know, I've just been thinking so much about him choosing water as the way to end his life. And what does that mean?
And you know, the other thing is, have you looked at the cover of Impossible Vacation recently?
No.
It's a picture of a man underwater with just his arm up holding a little flag.
Oh, gosh. I remember the poster.
Yeah, which I, you know, didn't... I mean, Swimming to Cambodia, everyone knows it's Spalding in the water with, you know, from his nose up. But I completely forgot about the cover of Impossible Vacation until, like, maybe 2 weeks after he disappeared. And how that plays... Or even Slippery Slope. It's like he's in an avalanche on the mountain, you know, the ski tips up and the snow over him. It's all about water. It's all about water. It plays a very strong theme in his work. It's one of the reasons why we moved to Sag Harbor, because he really wanted to be near the water. And, you know, and he grew up near the water and in Rhode Island.
Do you have a sense of what he believed about death and what if anything,
would happen to his, you know, his body or his soul, his spirit, if he thought about that kind of thing. It's the kind of thing he'd bring up in monologues.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know what he really thought.
I don't know what he really thought either. I mean, he went back and forth to believing that there was absolutely nothing after death, to maybe there is an afterlife. Maybe there is something else out there. I don't think he did anything thinking, okay, I've got to get to the next level. I truly believe, and this is where the acceptance of what he did and the forgiving yourself, that there was nothing you could do, that he just felt this was his only option, that he just could not be in this world the way he was any longer, that he couldn't contribute anything more, he felt, I think, that there was really no point in continuing. And I have to, I mean, and hopefully our children will one day, is accept that, you know, this was his decision, and that we not respect it, but we need to understand it, that he was in so much pain, and pain even living with him every day, that obviously I didn't know the degree to which he was suffering.
Kathy, I'm so sorry for your loss, and I just want to say thank you for sharing some of your thoughts and experiences with us.
Thank you.
And I just want to let you know how much Spalding meant to me as somebody who was often in his audience and who always waited for that next monologue. Kathy Russo is the widow of the late Spalding Gray. She runs the Washington Square Arts and Films Agency, which used to represent him.